You ready?
Yeah, let's do it.
Good morning, everyone. Today we're going to talk about deploying Windows with Configuration Manager, focusing on 2012 SP1, and then also moving. Then Aaron's going to cover R2. I'm going to introduce myself. I'm Jason Githens, a Senior Program Manager Lead on the Enterprise Client Team. We have Configuration Manager and Intune combined, so we work in the OS deployment area.
And I'm Aaron Chakowski, Senior Program Manager on the same team.
So I cheated on the agenda a little bit, but we're going to start with, I'm going to cover what's new in SP1, maybe old news to some of you in the audience. You may already be well on your way with SP1, but it's going to be a little bit of a backdrop to segue into what we've done with R2. So just to know kind of where everyone is, could I get a show of hands of everyone that's currently on SP1? Okay. Anyone still on RTM of 12? All right, so everyone's on 12's on SP1. And 07? 1.2? All right. Anyone on R2 yet? Came out Wednesday, or preview. Okay, so it looks like a pretty good size, a pretty good number of you on SP1, so some of this is maybe information you already know, but I'll try to, you know, point out, you know, interesting information as we go through it. So in the SP1 section, what we're going to talk about is are the key features added for SP1 and OSD, the biggest one being support for Windows 8 and Windows Server 2012. You get a little bit into UEFI and how we work with UEFI and why UEFI is important. The updates to pre-stage media, which were long in coming, some big asks that we've had from customers, which we're happy to have in the product as well. Going to go into Windows to Go self-provisioning, which really is another form of pre-stage media, which I'll point out when we get there. And some updated task sequence wizards to handle things like UEFI and BitLocker in the wizard workflow, as well as some additional OSD improvements. So setup changes, the main thing to talk about here is that there is a new version of, or the WakeIt for Windows 7 is replaced with the ADK. That's the biggest change, and there is a dependency to upgrade the product or install SP1, even fresh install of SP1, to use the checks for the Windows 8 ADK. When you do that, our prereq checker will first validate that you have ADK installed. We will update the default boot images. Custom boot images will still need to be manually updated, but we do automate the creation of the required USMT package that ships in that ADK bundle. The ADK consists of a number of tools that we depend on. They're actually built by another team, but we snap them into our product and use them to really orchestrate the entire OS deployment workflow. The reason that, you know, you may wonder, well, why is the ADK updating, or why does it have to update with every Windows release? Well, it's really built in parallel with that version of Windows, and it takes advantage of some of the capabilities of Windows and then moves that into the ADK for deployment purposes. If, for example, there are new processor security standards supported at the kernel level for Windows 8, then the ADK team will bring those into the ADK tool set so that you can take advantage of those through ADK as well. So it's not something we just always want to make you upgrade to the latest ADK just because it's new. There are fundamental, core OS reasons why the ADK is required. And the Windows 8 ADK, I will actually go back and support Windows 7 and XP as well. So this is just a basic table of what components of the ADK go on which site systems. The Windows deployment tools, they will go on your central administration site server, primary site server, and any of your SMS provider site systems. Windows PE, same list of site servers. USMT is just at the top level server, so that could be your CAS, or that could be your primary site server if you're running with only a standalone primary site server. The other, I already mentioned the prereq check, which runs. That's the annoying little error message that pops up if you haven't gone ahead and done the ADK install. Windows 7, the Wake, also needs to be removed from these systems before you try to upgrade them or install Service Pack 1. So in USMT, the changes for USMT, there is a new version for Windows 8. And before I get too deep into this slide, I want to understand where you guys are in your XP migrations by just show of hands. So anyone that's still on XP, almost with more than half your client base, raise your hand, please. Okay, a few hands there. Okay. Any of you guys that just raised your hands, also raise your hand if you plan on going from XP to 7 in the next, say, 6 months. Okay. And anyone plan on going XP to 8.1? No one's making that leap from XP to 8.1. Okay, cool. I just wanted to know where people were going with their XP upgrades, if they were going to skip 7 or go to 8.1. I was just curious about that. So one of the USMP requirements is that the required version is dependent on the destination OS. So for example, if you're trying to get to 8, or as Aaron will talk about a little bit, 8.1, you need the USMP version that comes with the ADK for that particular operating system. If you're going version to version, say XP to XP for just a reimage, then you need to use the version of USMT that's shipped with XP SP3, which is 3.0.1, and that's available in the download center as an independent component. So it's not rolled up in the ADK because the ADK came out with 8. So this is a table to really just help you navigate which version of USMT do I need for state migration. And as I'm sure you all know, USMT is used for that reason. It's to move data and state from when you go from one system to another, one OS to another. And this is really, that's pretty self-explanatory. The slide's in there for your future reference if you need it. Really, the only point to make about Windows 8 and Server 2012 support is it's effectively like Windows 7 and Server 2008 R2 deployment. There's not a lot changed in the mechanisms to deliver those operating systems. There are changes in the tooling used to deliver those operating systems. But the workflows aren't drastically different. I'll get into some nuanced differences in the task sequence workflow, some changes in pre-stage media like we talked about at the top of the deck. But effectively, it's OSD. It's a task sequence that uses your variables, follows a path, and drops an OS on the system. From a server standpoint, for OSD-specific site system roles, the bullet point matrix under that second bullet is really what is supported. What works on Server 2012, the state migration point, distribution point with Pixie. And distribution point without Pixie would work on Windows 8 as well. So that's just a support matrix of the servers related to the OSD site system roles. UEFI. So this is a long overdue update to BIOS, effectively. BIOS is older than, probably about as old as I am. And there was a need, really an industry need, to have a more modern firmware interface to get to that from push start, turn the system on, to get the bootloader, to get into the OS. And UEFI is that. You probably know a lot about UEFI. It's a lot's been published on it. But just as a kind of an overview, the important part about, or probably the most important part about UEFI relative to Windows 8 is in security and secure boot. Secure boot assures that the bootloader is trusted and signed. It's a known bootloader to Windows, and it prevents the injection of bad stuff before the OS loads. That's the key part of UEFI secure boot with Windows 8. The other key piece of UEFI and Windows 8 integration is a concept called ELAM, or Early Launch Anti-Malware, which actually allows the anti-malware driver, which Defender supports this out of box, System Center Endpoint Protection Client supports this out of box. It basically loads the anti-malware driver before any other drivers or third-party components load, so that the malware agent can track the security or the integrity of the system from first boot up all the way to full OS. Whereas before, in legacy BIOS, there was more of a there was an injection point there for, say, rootkits, where an unsigned or an untrusted bootloader could load, and you could end up with a rootkit or malware, a bad driver. And so this UEFI really locks that process down end to end. That's the reason I bring that up is that there's a lot of benefit there, and so we really wanted to enable the capabilities of UEFI in an OS deployment capacity. So there's a different disk configuration required, for example. So as one of our task sequence steps, we address that disk configuration. So you don't have to go guess what you need to make your partitions look like. That's native in the product. The other points to make, the last two here, are that the operating system architecture must match the device or must match the PC, unlike in BIOS where you could do 32-bit on 64-bit. You have to match the device for UEFI. You have to match the system architecture to the OS architecture. And this last statement around CSM, compatibility support module, is really around legacy drivers working on a UEFI machine. Every OEM will have a different way to do this. So it's really the reason we call the point out here is that, and if you can search for this online and you'll see lots of stories about Pixie didn't work when I had a UEFI machine and it enabled CSM to let the legacy driver for the NIC load. It's just a cautionary point to work with your OEM to understand what driver problems you might have with UEFI and what components may or may not work and what compatibility support or CSM they provide in that area, because it particularly impacts, from an OS deployment standpoint, it potentially impacts your ability to be successful with Pixie, and Pixie's key for bare metal scenarios. So that's the main reason we point that out there. This bingo chart, we're going to play a game with this later. This is just for your reference later. I'm not going to go too deep into this, but this is just a cross-section of OS and BIOS or UEFI. This is just really more of an appendix slide than something I want to get too deep into, but it's a handy reference chart when you're trying to figure out, is this OS work with UEFI? How do I approach this? And so it's just nice to have as a reference, and these slides are all available to you. So there is, so I gave my defense of UEFI or why it's a good thing, and this is really what we've done in reaction to UEFI becoming available. First point here is there's a new task sequence variable, underscore SMS TS boot UEFI. There's a new, like I mentioned before, new disk configuration required with GPT, FAT32 boot partition, an unformatted Microsoft Reserve partition, and an MTFS operating system partition. And our workflow will help you get that partition set right out of the box on a UEFI system. One note here is no support moving from BIOS to UEFI during a task sequence. And the special considerations for Pixie boot, that really just speaks back to what I said about that, CSM, and just assuring that your driver set is UEFI compliant. Or so you don't get into an issue where you buy a bunch of new hardware and you can't get them bare-metaled into OS deployment, bare-metaled into a new operating system.
One more quick note on that, too, is if previously you may have been able, and with legacy BIOS systems, you can use an x86 boot image to boot and deploy either an x86 or an x64 OS. With UEFI kind of matching up the Pixie support as well as Jason mentioned on an earlier slide, regarding the architecture matching the device, if you're deploying a 64-bit OS to a 64-bit UEFI system, you have to use a 64-bit boot image. You can't use that 32-bit boot image anymore.
Yeah, so just, I guess the simple thing there is just keep your architecture, your bitness,
exactly,
the same across the board.
Yep.
Pre-stage media improvements. I touched on these in that list of what we were going to talk about, and this has been a long-standing request of customers where, in previous releases, we've supported the pre-stage media for laying down the WIM. That's great, but then I've got to go pull all the content down that I need for apps and for apps, packages, programs, et cetera. And so now, with the release of SP1, you can that content can be included in pre-stage media. And I'll show a demo of that, how you can pick what to include in that pre-stage media so that it gets laid down. As it's injected into the WIM, and it's part of that pre-stage media. So when it boots, that stuff, that those apps are already there. The only caveat to that is if the content can't be found, or it's been revised, or it's corrupt, then it will go ahead and make a call up to the config manager MPDP and get the content back down. But it's a way to get everything you want into that pre-stage media without just the base WIM, then having to go download and provision all of that later. So it's a time and network saver. So you can select a task sequence, create task sequence media. This is just really a screenshot of what I'll demo, so I won't spend much time here. And during media creation, you can remove applications, packages. Oh, and I forgot driver packages as well. I forgot to mention that before. I'll demo that. So this is really a slide if you want to look at later for where to look for the steps. Hey, Windows to go. The pre-stage media scenarios, why do I need that? I'm sure you guys know that's, that's your OEM, that's your factory scenario where you send pre-stage media for your base image that you get from the factory. It's your build environment internally if you do it that way. Another third scenario or use case for pre-stage media is Windows to go. So with Windows to go, some of the reasons why you would want to use Windows to go are maybe contract employees that you just want to give them a USB stick, they snap in, they come in and do their job, and they snap the thing out. The disaster relief, the FEMA hurricane comes in, government agency goes out on site, they bring a bunch of USB sticks, they snap them into laptops, and they run their OSs off those USB sticks. A shared PC, traveling light, going to mom's house, and she has a PC at home, you bring your PC with you on a USB drive, you snap it in, you do work from it. Then those are just some of the examples of what you might use Windows to go for. And in some ways, it could be a bring your own device solution. It could be a way that you bring your own device. You could have your own, snap it into your home PC and work off your work environment off of your personally owned device. So you can build the Windows to go image using pre-stage media. You can deploy it as through software distribution as a package. And then there's a Windows to Go creator that launches that lets the end user, or the IT pro for that matter, basically lay down pre-staged media on the USB drive. Then later, you snap that thing in, you boot in, just like you would with a new PC. You boot into WinPE, everything gets provisioned, and that you're basically running off a full version of Windows 8 on Windows to Go at that point. So that's something I'll also demo. The other thing here in this little manage box in the bottom right corner is we do specifically tag Windows to Go devices in the console and in our database as a Windows to Go device or not. The reason for that is, as you can imagine, that these devices could sit in a drawer for a long time, and you don't necessarily want to account for them relative to your compliance numbers for software updates. So there's a flag for those devices, so you can kind of, in your reporting, you could exclude them if you wrote a report to exclude that device type by your query. That way you're not being held accountable for a USB stick that may be in someone's desk drawer at home, but you have a record for it and you don't know when the last time it was online. Surely, of course, it's not going to be patched because it's been sitting in a drawer, but we do flag that just so you can differentiate a Windows to Go device from a standard desktop. Oh, so we're at the demo slide. I'm going to combine together effectively Windows to Go and pre-stage media. Reason being is that you use pre-stage media to create Windows to Go. And the pre-stage media additions I can show in the same workflow of creating pre-stage media for Windows to Go. So I'm really combining those into one here. Oh, I need you on the wrong mouse. So the first thing I wanted to show is this flag that we have. And it is portable operating system false for this particular device because I'm not actually looking at a Windows to Go device in the console here. If this were a Windows to Go device, it would say, of course, true. So that's the flag. This is just a property sheet example of that flag that you can key off of to build collections, build compliance groups, for software updates primarily, and run reports against. So that flag is there. We go ahead and go to the console now and create task sequence media. Choose pre-stage media at the bottom. And I'll do site-based just to limit some of the wizard pages I need to go through. And I'll browse to my media file, which is not in the drivers folder.
Just type something.
What's that?
Just type something in. Just give it a name.
Oh. Wrong keyboard, sorry. To turn off protect with password and set user device affinity to allow.
We don't recommend disabling the password. It just saves some typing.
Exactly. Yeah, good point. And let's see where I'm my steps. I'm just going to click through this. I'm just doing some necessary pieces of the wizard to get to really what I wanted to show. Okay, finally. So now we've arrived at the add or remove application. So this is the new piece I was talking about with pre-stage media. So this is for app model based applications, and I can browse through add. I can choose to add. This will be a good one to throw in here. Let's put MDT 2013 into our image. And so we've added that one, and then we'll go to the packages. They're same deal here and same deal with driver packages. So that's really mainly what I wanted to show there is that this is the way you could add those. These are the last three I clicked through, application package, driver package, are new to pre-stage media in SP1. So I'm just going to cancel out of that, go to the path where we keep the files. So we install Configuration Manager SP1. In the Configuration Manager OSD Tools Windows to Go folder, there are a couple of files that you need to actually deliver Windows to Go as an application. And those files are under BitLocker, and that's by architecture, and creator. Now, this creator tool is the actual binary that you deploy with a switch, and I'll show you that in a second. And when you deploy that, it'll show up in Software Center. You run it. It will say pop a USB drive in your system. You click next, and off you go. So I'm going to walk through that process. We won't watch that whole thing go because, as you know, that can take a little while to finish, but we'll walk through the whole workflow. So let's just go back to the console, go to... going to go to applications, actually packages, and it's the Windows to Go package. So if we look at properties of that, it's just basically sourced from the, it's basically just sourcing that binary I showed you. If you go to program, we have the creator program, and the command line here is WTG creator, which is included on the media and placed in that directory I showed you. That's on your site server already. Then you pass the WIM name that you're using, and enable boot redirect. So there's just some switches you pass with media. You deploy that out. So we just look at the deployment. I've got that deployed to all systems. And cut over to Software Center, and you see Windows to Go Creator listed in Software Center here. So what I do next is I've already installed it once today, so I'll try it again. And that will pop this little creator application up. And it says I can't find a USB drive, which means I should put the USB drive in. And there it finds, it both finds and validates a USB drive that is approved to work as with Windows to Go. You choose that guy and click next. And it says it will format the drive. Are you sure you want to do this? Aaron, do you have any pictures on that thing?
Nope. It's all good to go.
All right. Let's go ahead and launch create and see what happens. So then it'll start. The key message there is this might take a while, so we're not going to sit here and watch this whole thing, but it is preparing the USB drive. We'll see how far we've gotten when we come back to the demo, but I'm not going to promise anything there. So the next little bit I want to talk about is the new task sequence wizard. There's a little screenshot of what's added there at the bottom. Oh, no, it's... Or is that related to the build and capture scenario? Anyway.
No, you're right.
That's okay. The automatic integration of BitLocker steps for Windows 7 or later, and the automatic steps for UEFI as well. And then for build and capture, and I'll show this in a demo as well, is updated to apply the image in place of running setup.exe in the build and capture process. So that's a change in SP1 as well. Additional improvements. You can manage the WinPE optional components directly from the Config Manager UI. So if you right-click and check properties of your WinPE boot image, you can see the components that are there. And I'll show a quick demo of that. Export and import drivers. And with BitLocker pre-provisioning, we'll talk a little bit more about that in our MDT session tomorrow. But that's actually really cool. Pre-provisioning of BitLocker really sets up It enables BitLocker in WinPE before it starts laying down the image, and therefore you don't have all the length of time to enable BitLocker. It doesn't have to go back to all the files that have been laid down. It does that as they're being laid down. So it's a much faster way to enable BitLocker during the imaging process without all of the overhead of trying to lay it down later on top of files that have already been written. And there's also the addition of pin support. So let's cut back over to the demo box. This is clearly not done. So let's go to the console, and we're going to start with the boot image properties. So we'll go here, and I'll just pick the 64-bit boot image, check properties, and it is under optional components. And so you see here, these are the components that are included natively in the boot image, and then there's some additional stuff you might want to add. For example, PowerShell support. So if you were to click on the PowerShell support, we were kind enough to identify all of the other dependent optional components that you need to enable PowerShell support in WinPE. So this will tell you you need, D.NET, and this basically will auto-check all those other optional components as well. So when I click OK here, those are auto-selected. If I were to go unselect one, say, I don't want .NET, that's huge. Then it's going to say, well, I'm going to uncheck all these other ones too. So we try to, we've matched up all of the components you need to be successful in a way that will auto-add the ones you need and will auto-remove them if you try to remove a component you think, well, maybe I don't want that one. Cancel out of that. So what do we do to create this? So next I'm going to show the new checkboxes in the UI for the UEFI and BitLocker components. So I'll just leave the default name.
Yeah. Just like the boot image.
Sorry, again, there's a little bit of prep work to have to do here.
It's those two checkboxes.
Those two. Okay. And then these are the two checkboxes here. It's a partition and format the target computer before installing the operating system and configure the task sequence for use with BitLocker. So those are just automated in the wizard now. You don't have to go back and edit the task sequence later and add those steps. So I know that was an incredibly exciting demo. The next one will wow you even more. So let's cancel out of that one. I'm going to create a task sequence for build and capture. basically what we're showing here is that you are installing you build and capture with an image file rather than setup.exe. And then I'll go over to the task sequence and edit that, and then show you that you can toggle that in the task sequence, but in not the wizard, we lock you into a choice because we want to push you in this direction. So that's the reason that's the default there. And last is edit the task sequence. It's just a double.
It's fine, yeah.
So the first thing to show here is apply operating system. And this relates to the last piece that I just showed you. The default in the wizard was to apply the operating system from captured image, but you can flip over to apply operating system from an original installation source. There's a little more you wanted to talk about on
that
piece.
You know, the one catch here is that in SP1, since it's using the Windows 880K, you can only do a setup.exe-based install with Windows 8. So that's part of the reason why we forced you into using an image in the build and capture scenario, is for other OSs that wouldn't be supported, and in some cases just don't work, running setup from the Windows 8 PE version. So that's the reason why we do that.
Okay. And then the next two pieces here I wanted to show is the two partition disk options. This is for traditional BIOS. And you see there's the system reserve partition here and the Windows primary partition. And there's also the UEFI partition that shows the four that I mentioned earlier. So these would be driven by variables, and you take the path of the one that you needed based on the BIOS or UEFI. And then the last one is pre-provisioned BitLocker. So this is just the step we talked about of that the new way of pre-provisioning BitLocker in a much more efficient way.
And just note that this comes immediately after partitioning the disk. So once the disk is partitioned and at that point completely clean, there's no data on it, when you enable pre-provisioning, it sets the flag to say, okay, encrypt any used space on the disk. Well, at this stage in the process of your task sequence, there's nothing on the disk. So that's where you get these advantages and these speed gains, is that from this point in the process, then, as it applies the OS image and does all these other things, it's doing the provisioning on the fly as data is being written to the disk. So it's just important to note that comes right after that partitioning step.
All right. We can take a couple questions for SP1 and then move into R2, or we can do. Oh, I see a question. Yes, sir. The question is, can you enable TPM from the task sequence?
I believe so.
I already closed the wizard. I think you can. Yeah.
Yeah. I believe there's options there to select the different types. TPM.
In that drop down.
Yeah.
So.
TPM with PIN, TPM with password. There's different options there. You can select.
All right, so now Aaron can talk about the really cool stuff, the new in R2. So
thanks, Jason. All right, so as hopefully you all know, we announced the release of, let me see if I get this right, System Center 2012 R2 Configuration Manager Preview. Did I get that in the right
That's
order?
Awesome, yeah. Well done.
Announced that yesterday, or the day before. I've lost track of days here. Really, with respect to OSD, the big add here is support for Windows 8.1 Preview and Windows Server 2012 R2. In very much the same way as Jason talked about earlier, with SP1 adding support for Windows 8 and the Windows 8 80K, with R2 we're adding support for 8.1 and the 8.1 80K. So we are replacing that version of the 80K. As Jason mentioned earlier, that's very closely tied with the version of the OS. So in order to support the newer OS, we also need to support that version of the 80K. Similarly, if you're deploying Windows 7, deploying Windows 8 is very much the same. And it's also very much the same with 8.1. There's not a lot of really deep architectural changes in terms of how the OS is deployed. There's some nuances and some subtleties, and we'll talk through some of those. But for the most part, OS deployment here is is basically the same. And as was noted on a previous slide, we have the same support for the OSD-specific site roles, the SMP and the DP with Pixie. So that holds true. One brief note here at the bottom, specifically with R2 preview, and I think actually that's I have a marketing bad here in how I'm referring to the product. But specifically with the preview release, it does require a minimum of Server 2008 R2 on your site server and your SMS provider. So if your lab environment where you're going to be testing this out, if for some reason you are standardized on Server 2008 in your lab where you want to test this, there's a hard block right now on the ADK, the 8.1 ADK. It has to install on Server 2008 R2. We're working very hard with the Windows team, and we'll have that addressed for the final release. But at least for preview, you do have to have a minimum of R2 on those, of Server 2008 R2 on those roles.
Just out of curiosity, how many of you would that be a problem for if you were going to production, say, today, that are still on Server 2008 or lower? Would that affect anyone
here? For your
here?
Site server or your provider?
Okay, a couple. All right.
Okay, thanks. So with SP1, you may be aware there were some challenges that was introduced with Windows PE. One of those was around some new processor requirements with Windows 8, this alphabet soup here of acronyms. Basically, there were some security requirements added to the Windows 8 kernel that required processors to have some new features to help secure boot and other things. The problem here is that Windows PE uses the same kernel as Windows 8, so it had those same requirements. So if you were trying to boot a boot image on either older hardware or maybe hardware with an older BIOS that didn't support this functionality, even if the hardware did, or certain virtualization platforms, you wouldn't be able to boot if they didn't meet these requirements. So that became a big challenge for a lot of customers who upgraded to SP1 and suddenly weren't able to deploy to some types of hardware or virtualization systems.
We really saw this a lot in the embedded space because of embedded typically runs on XP embedded devices, may have been around for years, that run whatever device they're running. And so we saw a lot of that there. Are you guys going to fix that, Aaron?
Hold that thought.
Okay.
Another one of the challenges that we had was just around supportability. So specifically with the Windows 8.1 ADK, it technically only supports the ability to deploy Windows 7 and above. So if you upgrade to R2, just by default, using one of the default boot images, you technically can't deploy. Well, you may technically be able to deploy, but from a supported standpoint from the Windows team, they're not supporting the deployment of XP or Vista, if anyone actually is deploying that still, using these newer boot images from the Windows 8.1 ADK. So, XP is still a supported operating system. And yes, there are customers using Vista. I've talked to a few, all two of them. Server 2008 is the same family as Vista, and there's a lot of folks using that. So this was a real challenge. How can we support our customers who need to deploy these older operating systems while still moving forward and using and supporting the newer version of the ADK? So what we're doing in R2, and actually this was also released recently with the cumulative update for SP1, is the ability to import a Windows PE 3.1 boot image. So this will come from the Windows 7 SP1 AIK. You'll have to install that on a separate system because you can't install both the AIK and the ADK simultaneously. And then you'll run some commands and do some manipulation of the image out of the wake and be able to create your custom boot image, which you can then import into Configuration Manager 2012 SP1 CU2 or 2012 R2. Now this note here that step-by-step instructions are to come, that's actually true today. So we posted just yesterday on our forum some basic instructions on how to do that. So go look out on the Config Manager forum on how to perform these customizations. And this will be updated into the product documentation later this summer. Now, the one caveat here is once you import these older boot images, you can use them, you can deploy OSs with them, and it's all in a supported manner. The catch is that you can't service those older boot images in console. So as you see from the screenshot here, the optional component tab that Jason showed earlier isn't there, plus a couple others, the customization tab and the drivers tab. So you can import these boot images and use them, but any customizations need to occur externally on this separate system using the Windows 7 AIK. The other thing to note here, too, is on the version tab or field there, you can see it's version 6.1. So that associates with the older Windows 7 version. Any of your newer boot images, when you upgrade to R2, they'll be noted by 6.3. So we do note that in the console, too, so you can see very easily which version of your boot image you have. In 2012 R2, we're adding the support and the capability to create and manage virtual hard disks. There's a couple of reasons why you might want to do this. Some of you may already have a virtual environment where you test out your task sequences, you make sure all the logic is valid, and it's not going to blow up before you actually go deploy to real systems. So this just kind of skips a few steps, right, in that process. So right from within the console, you can deploy a task sequence into a VHD, and it'll build it for you. And then you just snap that into Hyper-V and boot it up, and you're ready to go. So you don't have to build up a VM and pixie boot it and make sure all that's working. All you have to do is just create the VHD right there in the console. Additionally, there might be some customers that are using VMM or other products for their data centers where they're using VHDs. So you can use this process now to create those VHDs in the same way that you deploy to either physical or virtual systems that are live. You can deploy a VHD in the same way. So there's some good value there in terms of being able to integrate with your data center solutions. So we're adding a number of functionalities. Again, the ability to create a VHD, that's kind of the key one there. The one catch is you do have to have Hyper-V installed on the same system as your console. So I wouldn't necessarily recommend you install Hyper-V on your site server and run the console from there. Certainly the recommendation would be to have a separate system that has Hyper-V on it. You have your remote console, and you do all your work there. We have a new task sequence template that I'll show in the demo. We also have the ability to modify those VHDs. And I use the term modify a little loosely. Really what we're doing is we're taking that same VHD and rerunning the task sequence to the same VHD. We're not going in and trying to manipulate the VHD sort of live. It's really more of just resetting it back to a state that's known. And we also have the ability to upload to VMM. So right from the console, you can upload into VMM. So let's go take a look at what some of that looks like. Oh, and hey, our Windows to Go finished up here.
Can I try it?
Later.
Just reboot that.
Okay. So first let me show you, let me do it over here. It's easier to see. So with regard to the task sequence, we have a new, and you may have noticed this earlier as we step through this wizard, we have a new option now to install an image to a virtual hard drive. Now, take a look on the left-hand side. As I select these different options, we get more things in the menu here. When I select a virtual hard drive, it reduces down. There aren't as many things that are required here. You don't have to do a user state migration when you're creating a virtual hard drive. So we remove some of those options that aren't necessary. And I'll select the image package that I want to use. Now you can notice here that some of these options are grayed out. So we're not giving you the option to enable BitLocker as part of a VHD. At least today, that would cause some problems if you try to enable BitLocker in a VM. So we don't even give you that option. And this is also a little misleading. Yes, it is checked right now. It's a known bug in the final release. This will be disabled and unchecked. So it's obvious that it's not actually enabling it. Once we get through to the task sequence, those steps for BitLocker aren't there. This is just a simple UI bug. From there, it's basically a simple wrong keyboard. I did the same thing. Very similar, at least a few of the steps. We can add some additional applications if we want at this point. And then really, it's ready to go. It'll go through and it'll create a VHD for me. Or at least the task sequence is ready. I'm sorry. So
do you have to open Hyper-V or go out of the console at all?
Nope.
Or
just no? Nope. Okay. So you can notice I have Hyper-V Manager installed here, but it's not open. So there's nothing I need to do outside of the Configuration Manager console. So once I create that task sequence, I can then come into the virtual hard disk node and run the create VHD wizard. Ugh. You think I would learn? And I'll just put in I think I can do a, or is it going to force me to? Let me do it just so. File.vhd. So that's the VHD that I want to create. And then I'm going to choose the task sequence. So I've already created one for deploying 8.1 into a VHD. And it'll go through and it'll check in the same way that for example, the same way the pre-stage media goes through and checks the task sequence for all the dependencies and all the referenced media, and it'll add that in and show me exactly what it's going to be putting into this. Same sort of things here. Which DP I want to pull that content from. It shows me that this one has all the packages available there. I could do some additional customizations at this point if I want, and I'm ready to go. So it's very simple to step through. I'm not going to run this because it takes a bit of time. Let me show you, though, the fabulous screenshot I have of the progress wizard. It looks a little similar to setup. It takes some time. It's got some actions it's got to go through. In terms of creating the hard drive and the VM and that sort of thing, again, this is all happening in the background. So as this process runs, if you were to open up Hyper-V Manager, you would see the VM created there. And you could open that up, and you could see the progress occurring. But this is all happening automatically for you in the background. So it's a lot of the same steps that you might perform manually. We're now integrating that into a seamless experience.
So do you really use little clocks for icons?
Yeah.
Do they spin?
They don't. No. Sorry. Okay. We'll take that as a DCR, though.
That'd be cooler.
All right. So let's kick out of that. I'm not going to really go into the modify too much. It's a very similar wizard. The one key here, as I mentioned, is that we're locking into that existing VHD. So you're really just running the task sequence again on that same VHD or selecting a different task sequence to run on that same VHD. As you can with an image, too, you can schedule updates. So this is a really key thing here. If you create a bunch of VHDs and you're using those in a variety of different ways, you probably want to make sure that those are up to date. So in the same way that you can offline service your images, you can also do offline servicing of VHDs as well. I don't have any updates in this demo box. That's why you're not seeing anything here. And as I mentioned, if you have a VHD, you can easily upload to VMM. Now, I don't have a VMM server available, sorry. But you can at least see it's very simple. You put in the name of the server, you put in the library name, and you go from there. There's not a lot that's necessary here. Certainly other than setting up VMM, but that's a whole other session, so we won't get into that. All right, let's head back and talk about some other new features. So for those of you that are familiar with the Microsoft Deployment Toolkit, or MDT, there's the ability to integrate MDT into Config Manager and add a lot of really rich goodness into the OSD task sequence. Because of that popularity, and because the same team now owns both OSD and MDT, we've started to pull in some of those really primary and popular steps native into OSD. So the three that we chose for this release are validate, run PowerShell script, and gather. So you can do much of that same functionality now right inside of Config Manager without having to integrate MDT. Now, we made some name changes, and the functionality in some respects isn't an exact match, and I'll talk through that as we get into the demo. So the validate step we're now calling check readiness. it does basically the same thing. It checks a few key properties. And really the value here is being able to catch a problem before it does anything really drastic, like installing an OS or partitioning a disk. I've actually seen instances at customers where they misdeploy a task sequence to a collection, or a system gets added into a collection it shouldn't. So in one case, a customer actually reinstalled one of their Exchange front ends with Windows 7. Obviously caused some major mail issues. So the check readiness step can go at the start of your task sequence, and one of the key attributes that I'll show is whether it's a client system or a server system. So if you add that and you set it to client if you're deploying Windows 7, then that'll never actually run on a server OS. It'll fail right away. Run PowerShell script. We spent a lot of time poring over name choices here, and we made a really hard decision, and we decided to go with run PowerShell script in Config Manager. We thought that really kind of captured the essence of that step. So yeah, it's named the same, but it didn't really make sense to change it and name it something else. The key here, it gives you the ability to run a PowerShell script, surprise, surprise, right from the task sequence. And the difference between MDT and Config Manager here is we're adding the ability to set the execution policy. So you don't have to add some additional logic or policies or something to be able to do that. You can do it right from that step in the context of running that specific script. And then gather, we're calling set dynamic variables. It's not the full gather functionality. There's a lot going on with gather in MDT. But as I'll show in a demo, this gives you the ability to set a bunch of or create some rules in your task sequence that will then determine the values of task sequence variables. So it really adds a lot of dynamic aspects to your task sequence. So enough talk. Let's take a look at what that looks like. So I have prepared a very simple demo that uses all of these steps. So the first one here you can see is check readiness. For those of you that are familiar with MDT and the validate step, this should look very familiar. It's the same attributes, checking through some of the basic hardware requirements, and then here's that flag at the bottom as to whether it's a server or a client OS. Now, one key thing to note here is you can still set continue on error for this step, but then that really kind of negates the purpose of this step. If you say continue on error, it'll log, I'll show you later in the log file, it'll show that it did a matching here and that it failed, but then if continue on error is set, it'll just continue to run the task sequence. So
you get Windows 7 on your Exchange server?
Exactly, yeah. So just a word of the wise, I wouldn't recommend setting continue on error if you're using check readiness.
Maybe we should disable that.
That would make a good, yeah. run PowerShell script, again, looks very similar as MDT. You add a package, you specify the script, any parameters. There's Randy's little, he's one of our testers on the team who created this. He signed it for us, so. And then here's the ability to be able to set the execution policy. We're only using these three. They all signed, undefined, or bypass. You can't see that in the back. If there are any other execution policies that you think would be applicable in this scenario, come see me afterwards or in the booth or ask the experts or something. I'd be interested to hear if there's another scenario where another execution policy would apply. We only chose these three. They seem the most applicable. Another recommendation here is that if you're going to use these, I would recommend creating a single package that contains all of your scripts, and then you can specify that single package multiple times in your task sequence, and then just specify the specific script out of that package. So instead of having a whole bunch of packages, each with one script, it might make sense in your environment to have a single package, a single Uber package with all of those scripts in it. Okay, so then the next one here is set dynamic variables. I'm going to talk through this a little bit and then move ahead, and then we'll come back because I want to show you some more of this. So in this example, what I'm doing is have a very simple rule here. So at first, we're going to set the variable foo. We're going to set that to a value of bar. But then if the make of the machine and the model is a virtual machine, a Microsoft virtual machine, then we're going to set foo to equal bar 1. So it's a very simple example to see how you can change the value of a task sequence variable dependent upon some rule, some condition. So how we use that then is in this next step, just a very simple command line. We have a condition set on this step for the value of foo. If it equals bar 1, then run this step. So the outcome is that this specific step will only run on a Microsoft virtual machine. So hopefully that gives you an idea of how you can expand this into a bunch of different scenarios and use cases. So let's take a look at some of the other things that we can do with this. So we have a bunch of different types of rules that you can add. The first one is computers. Let's say there's a specific computer, your VP or your CEO or something. You want to make sure that certain things happen on that specific computer. Well, you can tag that by any of these attributes here, the asset tag, UID, serial number, or MAC address. And so you can say, hey, if any of these are met, then set these other variables. Location, what network is it on? So we're using default gateway as a way to determine the network. This could be used for setting the computer name. So let's say you set your computer names, you add a prefix of the computer name dependent upon the location it's in. The next rule is make and model, which is the one that you see here already. And then finally, you can also specify another task sequence variable. So depending upon an existing task sequence variable that's already set, you can key off of that to then set other task sequence variables. And it doesn't have to be specifically at equals to. You have all sorts of options here. So if it's a numerical value, you can do greater than or equal to or less than, all that good stuff. So there's a lot of flexibility here. Now, in terms of adding variables, we'll give you a picker list. So you can open this up, and it adds a good number of the inbox task sequence variables. And it's just a matter of checking those, and it'll show you down here at the bottom which ones you selected. The descriptions here are a little truncated from what you'll find on TechNet. So TechNet is your authority, is your source, as always. This is just a little helper. And then it'll add those in here. Now you see the value here by default is blank. So you do have to come through and then specify the value for each of those. But you also have the option to set it as a secret. And in some cases, I didn't select the right one there. Let me find one that is a password. So like capture account password. If I add that in, by default, it'll mark it as secret. So any password, it's going to say, hey, that's a secret. We don't want to show that. You can also, if you want, just add a custom variable. Now, this will look similar to that other screen. It's the same UI. But if you wanted to specify, we're going to create a new task sequence variable just for Jason.
After me. Thank you. What's so that one do? Not much.
Leave it up to your imagination. So you can specify your own task sequence variables. One key use of this, too, is if you notice, for those of you that really know your task sequence variables, you might have noticed, especially up here at the top, OSD adapter is missing. And if we scroll down, we'd notice OSD partitions is missing. Those are variable arrays. So the variable in itself isn't very useful here. You would have to add some of the additional aspects of that array to be able to make it useful. So we have a DCR. We'll get that added in the future. But for now, if you wanted to be able to either key off of or set something like OSD adapter enable DHCP, you would have to specify that as a custom variable. But you could type in that here. Adapter 0 enable DHCP. So you could specify that as a custom variable. But it'll still have the same effect. All right, so let me just give you a sense of what this looks when the rubber hits the road. So we're going to actually just run this task sequence. And we'll see it whip through these steps. They're all pretty quick. And now comes probably the most exciting part of the whole presentation, going into the log file. We know you all love looking at the log files. And yes, there's some errors. Okay, so first, you can see here, it does the pre-start check. This is the check readiness. It's evaluating the different variable, or the different values. Our memory is good, our processor speed is good, free space is good, and hey, we're running on a server, good. Okay, so that checks, exit code 0, let's move on. We run the PowerShell script, it goes through, it sets the execution policy, it grabs the package, and yes, Jason, I'm demoing an error. I know you love it when I demo errors. So
that's a lot of red.
It is a lot of red. Thank you, Trace. So what this script does, it's a very simple script. If you remember, there is that parameter Randy at US. It basically just creates a folder on the hard drive with the name of that. Well, that folder already exists. The reason I'm demoing an error here is just to show that we're actually exposing those errors out of PowerShell, out of the PowerShell host, exposing those back into the log file. So you don't just get some generic error that, oh, hey, your PowerShell script failed. Good luck with that. We'll actually expose that error for you so you don't have to go back and rerun your script to try to figure out what went wrong. Okay, so that continued on from there. We set our dynamic variables. You can see here it does a little bit of gathering, right? So it checks the MAC address, the IP address, some of the asset information. And then we are doing our evaluation, and it evaluates it to be false. This is running on a physical machine right now. It's not a virtual machine. So it says, oh, hey, your virtual machine, that condition is false. So the dynamic variable is not set, okay? So then if we come down just a little further, we're going to get to our run command line, and it's going to evaluate the condition on that final step to run the command line. And we can see it expands its strings. It sees that it has to check that bar is equal to 1. Well, since previously that rule failed, it didn't set it. So this condition evaluates the false. Because it's a physical machine, it's not a virtual machine. So that run command line is not executed in this instance. So just a quick example of how you can use the new dynamic task sequences. Hopefully that gives you an idea of how you can use that in your environment in a broader scale. All right, back to the deck. So let's talk about pre-stage content. And this is not to be confused with what Jason talked about earlier for pre-staged media. This is the ability to take content from your site server and send it out to a distribution point, a remote distribution point that might have a poor network connection. Now, we've had this capability in the product for a while for a lot of the different content. You can take applications or various things, create a pre-stage content file, and ship that off to the DP to be imported there. The catch was is if you had a task sequence that you wanted to deploy, you had to manually go through each of the references in that task sequence and grab all of that content individually and send that off. So what we're doing in R2 is we're combining all of that and we're given the ability to do pre-stage content right from a task sequence. And it'll reference all of the content that's necessary, stick it into I think it's one or two files, but it's all wrapped up for you to be able to send that off to the DPs. Let's walk through that real quick. Here. So as we can see on other nodes, like if we go into applications and select an application, we have the option to create a pre-stage content file. That's been around for a bit. But what's new in R2 is specifically from a task sequence, you can now create a pre-stage content file. So I'm just going to say, okay, let's put this in some folder. I could add some comments if I wanted to. So it goes and parses through the task sequence that I selected. And it says, hey, here's all the references that are in that task sequence. Your boot image, some packages and applications, that big OS image, you know, how big is it? Are there dependencies? It'll walk those dependencies too. So if you have applications with dependencies, where are you going to get all that content from? Which distribution point, you know, which local distribution point do you want to use? All that content is sourced on that one DP. And then we're ready to go. At this point, if we step through, it would take all that content listed up at the top for that specific task sequence coming from the specific distribution point and pull it down into these two package files here, these PKGX files. And total would be about a little over 3 gigs. So you'd go through that, you'd have those files, you ship them off to a DP, and you could import those there and not have to wait for that 3 gigs of content to trickle out over a slow WAN link.
So you can also include a Windows to Go stick and then put that in, get all the content down, laid down from that remote DP, and they never have to cross the wire.
There you go. Mm. Yeah, end to end. All right.
We've got one here.
Who's got a slow DP? Anyone? All right, so one final thing I wanted to mention. Not really something new that we're adding in R2. There's not any functionality that we spent time lighting up in R2. But it's a scenario that is really important that we wanted to talk about that does relate. And it does align in just in terms of timing. So, you know, when the Surface Pro came out, a lot of folks started looking at, oh, cool, how, you know, it's just running Windows, you know, Windows Enterprise and Windows Pro, so I should be able to deploy that OS using Config Manager. Well, there were some gotchas. There weren't any drivers available at first, and you couldn't pixie boot it. So you had to get a external media and you know, try to do it that way. So in, I think April was the first driver pack that came out. I think May is the most recent. Although I haven't checked recently, there might be one for June. And you know, if you hit this link, it's got that driver pack, as well as a quick start guide that some of our services guys put together that actually walks you through how to do this with both Config Manager and MDT, all the steps that you have to do, all the things you have to think about. So it's some great content there. The other thing that was added recently with the Surface Pro, there was a firmware update, I think in May, that added the ability to pixie boot a Surface Pro device. So now you don't have to carry around a USB stick or a external CD drive or DVD drive or something. You can do a bunch of these at once over the network, pixie boot them, and deploy the OS. I said right there, added with the May firmware update. I should read my own slides. You know, the catch, though, is that you do have to have a USB dongle. Wi-Fi is not supported for OS deployment, primarily because of Windows PE doesn't support it. And there's just some inherent performance issues. The other thing to mention is capsule packages. Again, the documentation here that's provided goes into more detail on this. It's what Surface Pro refers to for all the drivers and the firmware. So there's some kind of unique ways in which you have to deploy those, but the guide goes into a lot more detail in terms of how you can do that. So that's really the primary content we have. These are some of the other sessions that either went on yesterday. There's a few other that are going on tomorrow, especially our MDT session tomorrow afternoon. So if you're interested in MDT and what's new there, you know, feel free to come to that. You can come and check this out later. I'm sure if you come to some of the other Config Manager sessions this week or Intune sessions, you've seen a lot of this. You know, a lot of resources for you available here. More info up on TechNet and other such. More resources.
Boring. Any questions? And we do have a few minutes for questions.
We do have a few minutes. And
there's a microphone in the back. Sorry, you had more to say.
I was just going to say, you know, please do your evals. You can hit this QR code now, or you know, go to the sites and do the evaluation there. It's really important to hear, you know, how the session went, what you think, was it good, was it bad? We can then adjust
the right level
as need be. Yeah. So you know, please take some time and fill out that evaluation. Add any comments you want. You're certainly welcome to come up afterwards or later and throw things at us if you want. If you want to be anonymous, that's a great, you know, great place for the feedback too. So, yeah, there's a mic. I think it's in the back there. If you have any questions,
or you can come up here and we'll just do questions locally.
Yeah,
but give it a couple. We have five minutes. So
we'll be at the booth later and Ask the Experts too. So feel free to stop by later if you don't have time now.
Thank you.
Thanks all.